Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm David Finkel, Artistic Director of Music at Menlo, and it is my great pleasure to welcome you to the festival's 2013 season, From Bach. This season, Music at Menlo celebrates Johann Sebastian Bach, the composer universally recognized as the greatest in Western music history. To the ears of many modern listeners, the canon begins with Bach. And in the 2.5 centuries since Bach's death, arguably every major musical innovation has borne his influence. Bach's legacy endures, whether in the craftsmanship of composers from Haydn to Mozart to Mendelssohn, in the sonic magnitude of Brahms, Bartok, and Shostakovich, and even in the sensual allure of Debussy, Richard Strauss, and George Gershwin. Audio Notes are designed to enhance your enjoyment and deepen your appreciation of the music you'll be hearing at the festival. I'll be joined by Artistic Co-Director Wu Han, Music at Menlo's Artistic Administrator Patrick Castillo, and some of this season's festival artists to offer historical and cultural context and a variety of perspectives on this summer's concert programs. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to seeing you at the concerts.
Lauded in his own lifetime as a virtuoso organist, Johann Sebastian Bach's impeccable writing for keyboard distinguishes much of his compositional output, including such masterpieces as his Concerto for Two Harpsichords in C Major, which begins the summer's first concert program, Piano, Piano. The sonic breadth that Bach imagined is given voice by two modern Steinway pianos, an anachronistic testament to the timeless resonance of Bach's art. Franz Schubert's Rondo in A Major for piano four hands coaxes orchestral immensity from one keyboard. Robert Schumann's Andante and Variations likewise exploits an alchemical ensemble of two pianos, two cellos, and horn to ravishing effect. The program concludes with the path-breaking sonata for two pianos and percussion of Béla Bartók, one of the towering geniuses of early 20th century modernism, who numbered Bach among his essential influences.
The biography of Johann Sebastian Bach is one most effectively understood through the lens of his music. We don't have the same treasure trove of biographical anecdotes for Bach as we do for, say, a composer like Mozart, the miraculous wunderkind whose letters betray a scatological sense of humor contrary to his sublime musical language. Or Beethoven, the angst-ridden firebrand whose deafness we have as a metaphor for the ethos of struggle and transcendence so central to our understanding of who Beethoven was. No, the enduring image we have of Bach is simply that of a musician, an organist and composer of extraordinary ability, an industrious worker tirelessly devoted to his craft, and a creative genius whose music brought together technical mastery and emotional depth to such an overwhelming degree that he remains, more than 2.5 centuries after his death, arguably Western music's single most important composer. Bach was born in 1685, orphaned at a young age, and showed a tremendous instinct and aptitude for music as a child. And his musical ability, combined with his ambition and shrewd business acumen, essentially propels the trajectory of his entire life and career. Here's how Bach's obituary, an important document assembled by Bach's son, the composer Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach, and his student Johann Friedrich Agricola, here's how the obituary accounts for the early part of Bach's career. In 1703, when Bach was still just 18 years old,
he took on the duty of organist at the new church in Arnstadt. Here he really showed the first fruits of his industry in the art of organ playing and in composition, the latter of which he had largely learned only by observing the works of the most famous and thorough composers of the time and by applying his own contemplation to them.
Okay, a quick nota bene right away. According to the obituary, Johann Sebastian Bach was self-taught as a composer. Just think about that for a minute. The obituary continues.
In 1707, he was called as organist at St. Blasius Mühlhausen. However, this town could not have the pleasure of keeping him long. In the following year, 1708, he made a visit to Weimar, and the opportunity he had there to be heard before the then Duke led to the position of chamber and court organist being offered to him, of which he took possession straight away.
After nearly a decade in Weimar, the obituary continues.
The then Prince Leopold of Anhalt-Köthen, a great connoisseur and lover of music, called him to be his Kapellmeister. He took up the position without delay and held it for almost 6 years to the greatest satisfaction of his gracious prince.
And then, following these appointments in Arnstadt, Mühlhausen, Weimar, and what was an especially happy post in Köthen, Bach was elected in 1723 at the age of 38 to the position of music director and cantor in Leipzig, where he taught at the St. Thomas School and directed all musical activities at the city's two churches, the Thomaskirche and the Nikolaikirche. Bach would remain in Leipzig until his death in 1750, and produced many of his mature masterpieces during his time there. In fulfillment of his church duties during this period, Bach created his greatest sacred works, the cantatas, the St. Matthew and St. John Passions, the B minor Mass. But Bach's second decade in Leipzig saw the creation of much of his great instrumental music as well. In 1729, Bach assumed the directorship of the Collegium Musicum, a concert series presented by local musicians and students, which had been founded in 1702 by Bach's contemporary, Georg Philipp Telemann. The Collegium presented weekly concerts for the Leipzig Kulturradi, primarily at the consequently iconic Zimmermann's Coffee House near the city center. Bach programmed music by Telemann, Corelli, Vivaldi, and other leading composers of the day, and also composed much new music himself for the series. With the Collegium as a newly available outlet for Bach's creativity, in addition to the church, the 1730s saw a revitalized output of keyboard, chamber, and orchestral music to match the inspired catalog of sacred vocal music composed over the previous decade. Harpsichord concertos comprised a significant part of Bach's compositional output for the Collegium Musicum in the 1730s. He wrote 8 harpsichord concertos, all around 1738, which are all transcriptions of earlier concertos for wind or string instruments. In addition to these, Bach also composed, several years prior, a number of concertos for multiple harpsichords, which are likewise transcriptions of earlier works. There are 3 concertos for 2 harpsichords, one of which is based on a concerto for oboe and violin, another on the well-known double violin concerto. There are 2 concertos for 3 harpsichords, which likely come from earlier concertos for 3 violins, now lost, and whether they were by Bach or another composer, scholars are unsure. And there's a concerto for 4 harpsichords, which is an arrangement of Vivaldi's concerto for 4 violins from the Opus 3 collection Lesser Armonico. Of the various harpsichord concertos, the concerto number 2 for 2 harpsichords in C major, BWV 1061, is a bit of a special case. The only original materials that exist are the individual parts for the keyboard soloists. The string parts were only written out later. Rather than an arrangement of a double violin concerto, the C major concerto is thought to have originated simply as a work for 2 harpsichords with no string accompaniment. And indeed, the slow second movement remains scored for just the soloists, providing an intimate and introspective foil to the more exuberant outer movements. By the way, what you're hearing in this recording, of course, and what we often hear in today's performances of Bach's harpsichord concerti, are modern pianos, not harpsichords. The concerto follows the conventional Baroque 3-movement fast-slow-fast structure. In the outer movements, the keyboards also assume unquestionable primacy. Throughout the movement's opening section, called the ritornello, more on which in a moment, the dialogue between the keyboards propels the music forward, with the strings serving to provide texture, doubling the keyboards to emphasize this melodic idea, then getting out of the way to cast the next phrase in a different light. All the while, the soloists remain in the foreground. What we just heard is the ritornello, and the Baroque concerto form developed by Bach, Vivaldi, and others revolves around the ritornello. In fact, Baroque concerto form is just as often referred to as ritornello form. The word comes from the Italian ritorno, meaning return. And what the ritornello is the central theme of the movement, which is played at the start by the full ensemble and then returns throughout, but fragmented and in different keys. In addition to this constant transformation of the ritornello, the other important characteristic of Baroque concerto form is the alternation of solo passages and tutti passages, or passages played by the full ensemble, and the dramatic energy that derives from that back and forth. Listen to some of the music that follows the opening ritornello, and notice that solo tutti dynamic between the pianos and the strings, and also listen for familiar melodic fragments from the ritornello. The final movement is a fugue, a particular specialty of Bach. In a fugue, two or more voices present a central thematic idea, called the subject, in succession. And the rest of the fugue is subsequently built on the contrapuntal treatment of the subject among the different voices. The fugal finale to the C major concerto begins with the first keyboard stating the cheerful subject, first in the left hand, then in the right hand, and on different pitches. After a third statement of the subject and some further figuration, the second piano joins in. Like the first piano, the second piano presents the subject first in the left hand, then in the right hand, all the while expanding the fugue's rich contrapuntal sonority. Then, after the pianos have held court for the entire second movement and offered an extended exposition to the finale, the strings re-enter, providing a sudden splash of color to the fugue.
The season themes is the enduring resonance of Bach's legacy throughout Western music history, and his keyboard concertos offer a concrete example. They are an important precursor to the classical piano concerto and arguably the most sophisticated works of their kind in the era before Mozart and Beethoven. The rest of Concert Program 1 follows a different dimension of the C major concerto through subsequent generations. Not the concerto model, but the sonic breadth of music for two pianists, a tradition that found one of its greatest proponents in Franz Schubert.
Franz Schubert, one of Western music history's greatest geniuses, was born in Vienna in 1797, the only composer of the Viennese canon native to that musical capital. His was a Vienna revolutionized by Beethoven's powerful symphonies, but likewise under the spell of Rossini's delectable operas and the thrilling virtuosity of Niccolò Paganini. In this environment, Schubert quietly produced an astounding body of work. The American composer John Harbison has credited Schubert with writing, quote, the best piece in every genre he really tackled, end quote. These included, most notably, more than 600 Lieder songs for voice and piano, as well as an extensive catalog of piano music, chamber music, and symphonies. In all of these, Schubert demonstrated a sublime instinct for melody and an expressive depth that have endeared his music to listeners for nearly two centuries. Schubert's musical life was as ephemeral as it was remarkable. He took gravely ill in 1823, contracting what was almost certainly syphilis, and died 5 years later at the age of 31. But despite his great physical suffering and psychic anguish at the end of his life, Schubert remained incredibly prolific. In the final year of his life, Schubert completed the two piano trios, the Ninth Symphony, appropriately known as The Great, the Cello Quintet, and the last three piano sonatas, among numerous other keyboard, vocal, and orchestral works. All told, an imposing set of masterpieces, miraculously concentrated within a deeply trying 12 months, and unequaled by many composers over entire lifetimes. The Rondo in A major for piano four hands, also known as the Grand Rondo, is one of three outstanding works for piano duet composed during this remarkable period at the end of Schubert's life. The other two, the F minor Fantasy and the Allegro in A minor, nicknamed Lebenstürme, are dark and tempestuous works. The Rondo, however, belies the pain and suffering of Schubert's final illness. The term Rondo refers to the work's musical form, in which a central theme, or refrain, recurs in alternation with contrasting sections of music, called episodes. The beguiling theme that begins Schubert's Grand Rondo gives lie right away to the idea that a composer's creative output directly correlates to the events of his life. It's winsome and carefree, and it's a perfectly representative offering of the piano duet literature, which evolved, after all, not as concert hall music, but as a more private medium, designed to be enjoyed by friends in an intimate setting. But the Grand Rondo's simplicity is deceptive. Its charm masks its ingenious design. First of all, a typical classical rondo might begin with a straightforward 8-bar refrain, followed by an equally straightforward 8-bar episode, then the refrain again, etc. But Schubert's refrain, despite its unassuming character, is so expansive and generous, 32 bars long, with each phrase and each gesture unfolding so naturally from the previous one. Matching the refrain's breadth is the sprawling first episode that follows. Again, defying the common simplicity of the classical rondo, this episode contains no fewer than four distinct melodic ideas. It's as if the form were insufficient to contain Schubert's melodic imagination. And each musical idea, also characteristic of Schubert, is rich with expressive nuance. The episode begins with an understated opening, which blossoms into a brighter but still delicate phrase. What sounds like a simple transition to the next theme, Schubert deftly extends into a fully formed musical idea in its own right. Then a new chorale-like melody. Finally, a gently swirling melody takes the music back to the refrain. That's all within the first episode. A wealth of musical ideas that, for another composer, and I don't just mean a lesser composer, even for a great composer like Mozart or Beethoven, a wealth of musical ideas that might have served as the basis for a fully developed sonata form movement. Schubert works into what is ostensibly a less sophisticated structure, rondo form. But Schubert's melodic genius elevates what is usually a simple form into, indeed, a grand rondo. The rondo's organic quality and formal daring are also audible in the interconnectedness of the episodes and the refrain. Rather than rest on the standard A-B, A-C, A-D design of the classical rondo, Schubert permeates the recurrences of the refrain with recollections of what we've heard in the episodes along the way. He also substantially varies the refrain each time we hear it. It's as if, further demonstrating his restless inventiveness, Schubert is combining elements of rondo, sonata, and theme and variations, three of the classical period's definitive musical forms, into one inspired hybrid, innocuously published as a rondo. After Franz Schubert's death in 1828, arguably with the exception only of Felix Mendelssohn, the German composer Robert Schumann emerged as the most important musical figure of the early Romantic period. The Andante in variations for two pianos, two cellos, and horn represents something of a curiosity in Schumann's oeuvre by the mere fact of its unusual instrumentation. Schumann composed the work in 1843, shortly after completing two of his most important chamber pieces, the piano quartet and piano quintet, both composed in 1842, and each likewise prominently featuring the piano. For whatever reason, Schumann was dissatisfied with the Andante and variations, and withdrew it from his catalog. But at Mendelssohn's urging, he later republished it in a version for two pianos. In 1868, more than a decade after Schumann's death, his protege, Johannes Brahms, saved the original version from historical oblivion, giving its public premiere with Clara Schumann. In 1893, with Clara's blessing, Brahms published the original version, restoring the Andante and variations to the literature in the form most commonly performed today. Much like Schubert's late piano duets, Schumann's Andante and variations combines intimacy with immensity. Its muted character suits the private setting of the piano duet genre. But the inclusion of two cellos and horn lends the work considerable weight and variety of color. Those instruments' range of timbres magnifies the sound qualities of the piano. Introspective passages are made richer and warmer, as in the slow introduction. And brighter passages are made more brilliant. What we have in the Andante and Variations is a quintessential study in romantic expression. Following the slow introduction, the pianos, in dialogue with one another, unfurl just an enchantingly lovely theme. Following this theme is a set of 12 variations. These variations are impressive not only in Schumann's imaginative transformation of the theme in each one, but also in their dramatic flow. The first four variations grow increasingly animated and flow seamlessly one into the next, giving the impression less of a series of variations on a theme than of one long, steadily evolving musical thought. Another characteristic of the Andante and Variations that you'll notice right away is that the two pianos remain primarily in the foreground throughout the work. The cellos and horn serve to add color, accent certain lines, and fill out the harmony. Schumann's piano writing pays homage to the instrument's full spectrum of sonic possibilities, from warm lyricism to orchestral grandeur and brilliant virtuosity. That said, the cellos and horn do have their moments to shine. The fifth variation has the feeling of a funeral procession and calls on a martial rhythmic figure from the horn above keening lines in the cellos. And later, in the ninth variation, the horn comes forward as soloist, bellowing a majestic hunting call. One of the piece's most striking moments comes in the midst of the variations, immediately following the funeral dirge. Schumann quotes the song Seit ich ihn gesehen from his song cycle Frauenliebe und Leben, composed 3 years previously. The text of this song has to do with a young woman's amorous feelings towards the man she eventually marries. Thinking again of the Andante and Variations as a portrait of romanticism, Schumann's use of that song contributes mightily to the overall ardor of the work.
The program concludes with Béla Bartók's sonata for two pianos and percussion.
The Hungarian pianist and composer Béla Bartók ranks alongside the likes of Claude Debussy, Igor Stravinsky, and Arnold Schoenberg as one of the most original and influential composers of the 20th century. His viscerally compelling musical language drew from a wide range of influences, from Bach and Beethoven to his own contemporaries and even American jazz. Alongside these, another major aspect of Bartók's art that's perhaps of most lasting significance is his interest in and avid championship of Eastern European folk music. Bartók is generally regarded as history's first ethnomusicologist. He traveled extensively throughout the Eastern European countryside, listening to and recording Hungarian, Romanian, and Slovak peasant music, and his deep study of this music was the most important influence on his own work. Bartók's sonata for two pianos and percussion, while not explicitly indebted to folk traditions, is nevertheless one of his signature creations and a landmark work of the early 20th century repertoire. Bartók composed the sonata in 1937 on a commission from the International Society for Contemporary Music. And what Stravinsky once said of Beethoven's Grosse Fuge, that it is an absolutely contemporary piece of music that will be contemporary forever, can be said of this sonata as well. The kaleidoscopic array of sounds that Bartok coaxes from the ensemble is as gripping today as it was in 1938. What immediately strikes the listener about Bartok's sonata is that, though strictly speaking a piece of chamber music, it reflects an orchestral scope of thinking. Bartok decided that the enormity of sound he had in mind for the percussion section required two pianos to match. And the percussion battery itself resembles that of an orchestra percussion section: timpani, bass drum, cymbals, triangle, snare drum, gong, and xylophone, played between the two percussionists. This is unmistakably an orchestral battery. These particular instruments, especially bass drum and timpani, are almost never used in chamber music. Fittingly enough, in 1940, Bartok made an arrangement of the sonata as a concerto for two pianos, percussion, and orchestra. Right from the sonata's first measure, Bartok brings the listener into a mysterious and enthralling sound world. The piece begins with a whispered timpani roll, over which the two pianos introduce a sinuous chromatic theme, punctuated by loud cymbal crashes. The music builds to the main allegro section. The pianos play an urgent, breathless theme. Bartok exploits the percussion battery to striking effect. Throughout this passage, the xylophone and snare drum propel the two pianos' restless energy. A second theme emerges amid a dizzying whirl of timbres. After some frenzied piano figurations, highlighted gingerly by the triangle, the first theme returns, now couched in a surly triple meter march. This leads soon to a thunderous climax, marked by booming chords in the piano, surrounded by timpani and xylophone. Shortly before the first movement's conclusion, Bartok shows off his mastery of counterpoint. The second theme reappears, now as the subject of a fugato passage. Notice how, even without stating the pitches of the theme, the drums echo its rhythmic profile, essentially adding another voice to the fugue. The slow second movement illustrates a facet of Bartók's musical language that's come to be referred to as his night music idiom. Though not coined by the composer, Bartók approved of this term as shorthand for certain of his pieces, characterized in the works of Bartók scholar David Schneider by, quote, eerie dissonances, providing a backdrop to sounds of nature and lonely melodies, end quote. Following the second movement's mysterious stillness, the sonata concludes with a wild-eyed allegro non troppo. After a series of raucous dance-like episodes, the sonata finishes in unexpected fashion. Bartók wraps up his epic sonata, certainly one of the most gleefully clamorous works in the chamber repertoire, and one rife with piquant chromaticism, with a harmless C major chord, colored by gentle rapping on the snare drum and cymbal. Audio notes are authored and produced by Patrick Castillo and narrated by David Finkel, Patrick Castillo, and Wu Han. Additional narration is provided by Andrew Goldstein. Additional mastering is provided by Dahong Situ. Musical excerpts appear courtesy of the following artists and organizations. J.S. Bach's Concerto in C Major for two pianos is performed by João Carlos Martins, José Eduardo Martins, and the Sofia Soloist Chamber Orchestra, and appears courtesy of Labor Records. Franz Schubert's Rondo in A Major for piano four hands, performed by Paul Lewis and Stephen Osborne, and Dmitri Shostakovich's Piano Quintet, performed by the St. Petersburg Quartet and Igor Uryash, appear courtesy of Hyperion Records. Robert Schumann's Andante and Variations for two pianos, two cellos, and horn, performed by Vladimir Ashkenazi, Vovka Ashkenazi, Radovan Vladkovich, Georg Donderer, and Matthias Donderer, Bela Bartók Sonata for two pianos and percussion, performed by Martha Argerich, Nelson Friere, Peter Sadlo, and Edgar Gugeas, and Joseph Haydn's Quinten Quartet and Ludwig van Beethoven's Opus 132 Quartet, performed by the Emerson String Quartet, appear courtesy of Deutsche Grammophon. Bach's Fantasy and Fugue in A Minor, performed by Claude Frank, Mozart's String Quartet arrangements of fugues from Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier, performed by the Orion String Quartet, and Shostakovich's String Quartet No. 8, performed by the Miro Quartet, appear courtesy of Music at Menlo Live. Audio Notes is a copyrighted production of Artist Led.